The Day of Jubilee. Brother Harold, please.
Well, thank you, Brother Art. And good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. Every time Matt comes up here and gives a few words, he seems to be getting better and better, in my opinion. So thank you very much, Matt. There are quite a few in this audience who will remember the event of Queen Elizabeth II being crowned queen. I know one person in particular will know that. And there are even more of us who will remember the Golden Jubilee of that celebration of the coronation. And the reason I mention it tonight is because it outlines by practical example what is a jubilee. So how many in the audience do remember the announcement that King George VI was dead? Oh, you remember that? Quite a few do, yes. That tells you that they were born before 1952, because that happened on February the 6th, 1952. And as was expected under English law, King George's daughter, whose name was Elizabeth, signed the appropriate documents and a couple of days later proclaimed herself to be queen, and that was on February the 8th, 1952. Now, in 1952, I wasn't very mature, and perhaps you could explain to me, whoever might feel mature, after the class, why it took another 16 months for the new queen to actually receive her crown. You see, she officially proclaimed herself queen in 1952, but was not crowned queen until June the 2nd, 1953. That happens to be the birth date of Sister Margaret, I'm told. So she'll remember that. But then the celebration of this coronation took place in 2002 on June the 2nd. And that's exactly 49 years after her coronation. So this example helps us to understand what is a jubilee. If you didn't know before, you probably did, but there are 49 years involved. Then at the beginning of the 50th year, there's a celebration, as there was with the queen. And if you've been married for 49 years already, then the 50th year in its entirety is the jubilee year. Looking at the North American Dictionary, Webster, this is what he says about jubilee. Jubilee, it comes from the Hebrew word yobel, which means ram's horn. And among the Jews, every 50 years, or every 50th year, he says, there was a general release of all debtors and slaves, hence a season of great public joy and festivity. So that's Webster. Now, further research tells us that jubilee or yobel not only means a ram's horn, but it came to mean a trumpet that was made from a ram's horn or in the shape of a ram's horn. Now, these horns, they weren't just used by anybody. They were used by the priests. They were carried and they were blown by the priests, and they were used for religious purposes. And it heralded not just a simple release from labor and not just a rest, but it heralded a year belonging to God. So in Jewish circles, every seventh year was a Sabbath of rest for the land. In the old Jewish Mosaic law, a Sabbath of rest for the land, But the Jubilee year belonged to God. Let's have a look in the Leviticus readings. Leviticus 25, and we'll read a few verses there concerning the Jubilee. Leviticus 25, verses 1 to 7. And the Lord spake unto Moses in Mount Sinai, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When ye come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath unto the Lord. 6 years thou shalt sow thy field, and 6 years thou shalt prune thy vineyard, and gather in the fruit thereof. But in the 7th year shall be a Sabbath of rest unto the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. Thou shalt neither sow thy field nor prune thy vineyard. That which groweth of its own accord of thy harvest thou shalt not reap, neither gather the grapes of thy vineyard, of thy vine undressed, for it is a year of rest unto the land. And the Sabbath of the land shall be meat for you, for thee and for thy servant, and for thy maid, and for thy hired servant, and for thy stranger that sojourneth with thee, and for thy cattle, and for the beasts that are in thy land, shall all the increase thereof be meat. So what does that mean? Well, it means this, that the end of verse 2 there, the 7th year shall be a Sabbath of rest for the land and a Sabbath for the Lord. Now, in practical terms, the agricultural land was to lay fallow. You didn't cultivate it. You didn't prune anything that was growing on it. You didn't do any seeding. And there was no usual harvesting. But so this is on the 7th year. Whatever grew by itself with no help could be used for food. It could be used for food for man and beast, and you could go out and you could pick something for dinner if you wanted, produce or whatever. And the poor people could go out into other people's farms and pick food and help themselves. But no one harvested crops for business purposes in the normal manner of speaking. There was no regular harvest. It was there to be gleaned by almost anyone that wanted to glean it. Leviticus 25, verses 8 to 13. What happens after that? Thou shalt number 7 Sabbaths of years unto thee, 7 times 7 years, and the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto thee 49 years. Then shalt thou cause a trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the day of atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. And ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a Jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family. A Jubilee shall the 50th year be unto you. Ye shall not sow neither reap that which groweth of itself in it, nor gather the grapes in it of thy vine undressed, for it is the Jubilee. It shall be holy unto you. And although ye couldn't gather it, this is what it says in verse 12, ye shall eat the increase thereof out of the field. So you could go and help yourself. In the year of this Jubilee, ye shall return every man unto his possession. So there's a couple of things in those verses I'd like to emphasize. They were to number 49 years, then the entire 50th year was a Jubilee. And the year of Jubilee began with a yobel, and that was a ram's horn made into a trumpet. And on the 10th day of the 7th month, which originally was called Ethanim, but later called Tishri, the priest would blow that trumpet. And we happen to have a noise of a trumpet for you to listen to tonight. So this is not a fire alarm. So those in Simon Manor that might be listening, we don't have a fire alarm here. This is the sound of the ram's horn trumpet, the Jubilee. I think. Here we go. And it goes on and on. So we'll stop there for a moment. So that's the sound of the shofar. It happened on the Day of Atonement, and the 10th day of the 7th month is an annual event called the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur. And when the people heard that sound of the shofar on this particular Day of Atonement, that is at the end of the 49th year, I can't see John. That's that in the way like that. At the end of the 49th year, when you heard that noise, it marked something very important to those who were selling themselves to a landlord, working for him and doing things like that. It was freedom from servitude. If you look at, again, that verse 13 of Leviticus 25, in this year of Jubilee, ye shall return every man unto his possession. And verse 23 and 24 of Leviticus 25, the land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine. This is God speaking. The land is mine. And today in Israel, people are thinking about giving away some of the land that was belonging to the Jews. The Jews are planning on giving it away. This is bad because the land is God's, and you shall not sell the land forever. For ye are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the land of your possession ye shall grant a redemption for the land. So you couldn't get out of debt. If you were in debt, you couldn't get out of debt by simply selling your land. In actual fact, no one had what they call absolute, indefeasible title to their land. Nobody. It belonged to God, and it could not be sold. They didn't own it. They were granted it as a possession, but if you wanted to put it in modern terms, individual Jews were actually leasing the land from God. The price of the lease was zero. It was free. God granted this lease for free, and they could sublet. They could sublet this land that they got for free, and they could sublet it for money, but only until the year of Jubilee. Now, the amount of money they could get by subletting would be based on the number of crops that would be available to the person getting this property before the year of Jubilee arrived. So if it was 48 years, it would be worth quite a bit of money. If it was only 1 year, not very much. Because the lease went back to the family of the Jew to whom God had assigned it. And by the grace of God, he was entitled to that land. But in reality, God was the owner. Now those in the audience who remembered the Queen's birthday may remember May the 14th, 1948. May the 14th, 1948. May the 14th happens to be my mother's birthday. So in 1948, that no doubt would have been the most important event of the day. And my greatest interest in those days would have been looking after mother's birthday, but again, wanting to play soccer probably, or roller skating all over the streets of Brantford, Ontario, on ball-bearing, steel-wheeled, strap-on roller skates. I don't think you could buy those anymore, but that's what was available in 1948. And to the more mature people in that time, in 1948, they would remember something very important. That would be the declaration of the State of Israel, May the 14th, 1948. This is May the 15th today. So it's just yesterday was their anniversary. Of course, it wasn't really their anniversary. They have a different calendar, and they would have commemorated the event of the declaration of the State of Israel about 5 or 6 days ago or more, because their calendar is different to ours. But nevertheless, the State of Israel was born on May the 14th, 1948, and it was the first time in about 2,000 years that the Jews had a place that they could call their own. Now, that event of the declaration of the State of Israel just didn't happen. It was the result of toil by many people, and there were several periods of 50 years involved. What I'm saying is this, that in 1897, there was a Jew. His name was Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl, a Jew. I believe he was a newspaper reporter, but he organized the first Jewish Congress in Basel, Switzerland. And he proclaimed something, that it was the determination of this Congress that the Jews establish an independent state. They were determined to do that. And exactly 50 years later, in 1947, the United Nations organization voted to partition Palestine into Arab and Jewish states, with Jerusalem as an international city. And the next year, in 1948, the State of Israel was proclaimed. Now, this international city, of course, it didn't stay an international city, because it was to become the capital of the State of Israel. And that event also involved 50 years. In 1917, the British published what they call the Balfour Declaration, inviting Jews to return to their homeland, to their ancient homeland. This was an invitation. Many of them went back to Israel. And exactly 50 years after that declaration, the Balfour Declaration, in 1967, a 6-day war took place between Arabs and Jews. And it resulted in Jerusalem being taken and incorporated as the capital city of the State of Israel. Now, you won't remember all of that, so I've put it on the overhead for you. And those are Jubilee years which are of interest. The Queen's coronation and the Golden Jubilee and the Theodor Herzl's Jewish Congress, and then the United Nations declaration that they should have two states, the Balfour Declaration in 1917, and the Six-Day War of 1967. These are all Jubilee periods. Now, going back to Genesis, we know that Abraham was promised the land of Israel. He was promised the land as an everlasting possession. We also know from Galatians that we, as Abraham's seed through Jesus Christ, can be heirs. We can be heirs to the promises. Whatever the promises made to Abraham, we can be on the receiving end of those promises. And as Matthew mentioned, our names are written in heaven, written in the book of life. And depending on our activities in this life, we can anticipate being part of the promises fulfilled. The question is, when does Abraham and when do we receive this inheritance of the land of Israel? Now, many brethren believe that we all receive this inheritance in a Jubilee year, after a very major event, 50 years after a very major event. And that major event will be the return of Jesus Christ to the earth to raise the dead and to take us to the place of judgment. Then after 49 years go by, the land becomes Abraham's and Abraham's seed. So the question you might ask is this: is there a place in the Bible where these 49 years are laid out between the return of Jesus Christ and the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham? Now, one answer is found in the life of Ezekiel, the man of sign. And on your handout, you'll notice that Ezekiel received his first vision when he was only 29 years old. I think that's on there somewhere. Yes. It's on this page here. He received his first vision when he was 29 years old. And his last vision was of the temple city of Jerusalem in operation in the kingdom age. And he received that vision when he was 49 years old, or in his 50th year. In his 50th year, he saw the kingdom, the temple in use. He saw the land divided amongst the 12 tribes and so forth. Let's go to Ezekiel, and you might want to keep a marker in Ezekiel because we'll go there a few times this evening. Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Kibar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God in the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity. The word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kibar, and the hand of the Lord was there upon him. Now, from verse 2, we see that Ezekiel received this first vision during the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, which we can identify as being 593 B.C. That's the fifth year of his captivity. And from verse 1, the only logical explanation of that 30th year is the age of Ezekiel, which means he was 29 years old and in his 30th year when he received this first vision. So if we know that, then we can go backwards and establish the year in which Ezekiel was born, and that works out to be 29 years earlier, 622 B.C. Now, the last eight chapters of Ezekiel, they are a prophecy that took the mind of Brother Henry Sully for many years, and he wrote a book entitled The Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy. The last eight chapters deal with that. The details of those chapters are very complex, but the message is very clear. Ezekiel was given a vision of the temple city of Jerusalem in operation. He saw it operating as it would be in the kingdom age, and he was given precise details of how the land promised to Abraham would be divided amongst the tribes of Israel and also spiritual Israel, and that's you and me. Now notice the date. In Ezekiel chapter 40, verses 1 and 2, the date that Ezekiel saw this temple city in operation, and compare it to the date that is in the first chapter that we read. Ezekiel 40, verse 1 and 2. In the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was smitten, in the selfsame day, the hand of the Lord was upon me and brought me thither. In the visions of God brought he me into the land of Israel, and set me upon a very high mountain, by which was as the frame of a city on the south. Now this was the 25th year of Ezekiel's captivity in Babylon. 20 years later from chapter 1, making Ezekiel now 49 years old and in his 50th year of life. We have another overhead here which puts that together. So there it is. We have Ezekiel's birth, the first vision and the second vision, at least the last vision, and the dates and a few references that might be useful. But none of this proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the kingdom begins on the 50th year after Christ returns to the earth. It doesn't prove it beyond a shadow of doubt, but there is good supportive evidence elsewhere to make us believe that this will be the case. So for example, what happened in 622, the year that Ezekiel was born? What happened? Well, let's go back to 2 Chronicles and have a look at 2 Chronicles chapter 35 and verse 1 and 17 to 19. Now, this is the chapter where Josiah, good King Josiah, was reigning, and he did something very remarkable. 2 Chronicles 35, 1. Moreover, Josiah kept a Passover unto the Lord in Jerusalem, and they killed the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. That's logical, because that's when they were supposed to do it. 17 to 19. And the children of Israel that were present kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days. And there was no Passover like that kept in Israel from the days of Samuel the prophet. Neither did all the kings of Israel keep such a Passover as Josiah kept. And the priests and the Levites and all Judah and Israel that were present and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, in the 18th year of the reign of Josiah was this Passover kept. In the 18th year, 622. And there was no Passover like to that kept in Israel from the days of Samuel the prophet. This was the best Passover, the most elaborate worship of God that has ever happened on Passover day. Even Solomon's dedication of the temple and Passovers that he might have had did not compare to the Josiah Passover. So this is a landmark Passover in the history of Israel, a day to be remembered. And a Passover kept the very year that Ezekiel was born. And what does a Passover actually do? Well, a Passover marks the escape of Israel from bondage in Egypt, an escape from death. Think about that. Passover is escape from death. That's what it represents. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 5 in connection with this. 1 Corinthians in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and at verse 7 talks about a Passover. Purge out therefore the old leaven that ye may be a new lump, as ye are unleavened. For even Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. So we're connecting Chronicles with Corinthians. So that quite often we get those two books mixed up, don't we? But today we're actually comparing 2 Chronicles 35 with 1 Corinthians 5, verse 7. And there we're connecting three events. The first event is the Passover in Egypt. Josiah remembered that. And so we have the second event, the Passover of King Josiah. And then we have Jesus Christ here described as our Passover. Now think for a minute. Think of yourself as being in the grave. Now, you young people, that's as far away as from your mind as possible. But then you get into the older folks, and we think, well, maybe that isn't so far away. Let's think about ourselves being in the grave, and when Jesus returns, he will be our Passover. That's what 1 Corinthians says, isn't it? Jesus Christ is our Passover. In Egypt, if we know the story, in Egypt, the angel of death went through Egypt and destroyed all the firstborn amongst the Egyptians, but he passed over the houses of the Israelites. And in so doing, he saved them from death. And likewise, Jesus Christ will be our Passover because he will physically save us from death. He will bring us out of the graves. It'll be a time of resurrection. And at that time, Jesus becomes our Passover, saving us from death. We will all be resurrected, and hopefully we'll be given immortality, and then we'll have lots of work to do before the millennial age can begin, before the Jubilee year of Jesus Christ's return can begin. What is that? We're going to have a look at some of the work that must be done, but I would emphasize at this point that the prophet Ezekiel was a man of sign. When you go through Ezekiel, you get all kinds of information. His entire life, from the very beginning to the end, should be looked at as a shadow of things to come, punctuated by a birth on the greatest Passover ever, punctuated by a vision of the kingdom precisely 49 years later. In the 50th year, he sees the land occupied by each of the 12 tribes, and you and I are not excluded. Let's have a look at Ezekiel 47, where it talks about the land being separated, divided. Ezekiel 47 and verse 21. That's where it starts. Well, not exactly where it starts, but this is a good place to start at this point. Verse 21 of Ezekiel 47, "So shall you divide this land unto you according to the tribes of Israel." The previous verses in this chapter are giving a general overview of the separation of the land. And then read along all through chapter 48 until you get to verse 29. And we're not going to take time to do that, but that section between 47:21 and 48:29 describes how the land will be divided. Verse 29 of chapter 48, "This is the land which ye shall divide by lot into the tribes of Israel for inheritance, and these are the portions, saith the Lord God." So between these two verses, as I've said, the inheritance is defined, as well as a portion for Jesus Christ, located in the very center of the land. Now, you have a picture in your handout, but let's just have a look at it on the screen here. The very center of the land, I had a pen, here it is. In the very center of the land, we have the holy oblation, you notice. And that is the portion for the prince. And the prince is the Lord Jesus Christ. And you and I could receive our inheritance out of the prince's portion. How do we know that? Well, let's have a look at Ezekiel chapter 46, verses 16 to 18. "Thus saith the Lord God." Now, he's talking about inheritances here. "If the prince give a gift unto any of his sons, the inheritance thereof shall be his sons." So this is the prince's portion right in the center of Israel. "It shall be there in possession by inheritance." So the prince can give some land to his sons. "But if he give a gift of his inheritance to one of his servants, then it shall be his to the year of liberty. After, it shall return to the prince, but his inheritance shall be his sons for them. Moreover, the prince shall not take of the people's inheritance." In other words, he can't take of any of the inheritance of the 12 tribes by oppression to thrust them out of their possession. "But he shall give his son's inheritance out of his own possession, that my people be not scattered, every man from his possession. So did you know that the prince, Jesus Christ, would have sons? The sons of Jesus Christ are the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And because we are Christ's, we too can be called sons. Look at Psalm 45 to confirm that. Psalm 45 and verse 16. Instead of thy fathers, speaking to Christ, shall be thy children, whom thou mayest make princes in all the earth. So Jesus Christ will look at Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and normally people looking at their ancestors would say, they are our fathers. But he will look at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he will say, they're not my fathers, they're my children. Because they have the hope of Israel, and that hope is all centered in the greatest seed of Abraham, which is Jesus Christ. And they will become his children. And we too can become his children, and therefore the inheritance that Jesus Christ can allot out of his possession, as we read in Ezekiel 46, can become ours if God so wills. So now let's have a look at some other evidence. We have a few minutes to show that the kingdom age will not begin at the time that Jesus Christ returns to the earth. You see, there will be ecclesiastical opposition to that man in Jerusalem who has arrived there and who claims to be the king of the world. Now, in the symbolic language of Revelation, it will take 30 years for that opposition to be squashed. Now, if you look at Revelation chapter 14, and verses 6 and 7, you see there a few verses which are in the center of a chapter that describes the Jesus Christ as the king in Jerusalem. And Revelation 14, verses 6 and 7. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell in the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and fountains of waters. So Jesus Christ, you'll notice in verse 1, is on Mount Zion with the 144,000. That's you and I, God willing, the glorified saints. And the first job that you will have is to preach the everlasting gospel, verse 6. And many brethren, and I'm one of them, believe that this will take a period of some 10 years to be undertaken. So all over the world, the gospel we will preach to every creature under heaven, and they will have the opportunity to accept it. And following that, that worldwide concerted effort by the glorified saints and Jesus Christ, there will be a 30-year period needed to remove those who are opposed to the rule of Christ. And for those interested, there's a little mathematics describing this 1 hour of Revelation 14 and verse 7. At least I thought I had some mathematics. Here it is. How does 30 years come out of 1 hour? Well, it's just a simple algebraic equation. And we read Ezekiel chapter 4 and verse 6, where there's a day for a year principle employed. And 1 hour, one 12-hour day, a Jewish day, equals 12-month year. And then by simple algebraic cancellation, we have 1 hour equal 1 month, and 1 hour equals therefore 30 days, and 30 days can equal 30 years. So that's how you get 1 hour out of, at least 30 years out of 1 hour. And this is what Revelation is really saying, isn't it? That the hour of his judgment is come. Worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Now the conclusion, this conclusion, as we said, is reached by comparing these verses with Ezekiel chapter 4 and verse 6, where we remember Ezekiel lay on his side, and in all of those verses that our chairman read, we remember he lay on his side for 390 days and then for another 40 days. Altogether, 430 days he was lying on his side. It was a sign to Israel that they would be oppressed for 430 years. When did that happen? Well, when the temple was destroyed, the temple that Solomon built was destroyed in 586, the Jews were oppressed for 430 years. And 430 years later, after the temple was destroyed, the Maccabees proclaimed self-rule in 156 BC. Exactly 430 years later, they had control over the land again for about 100 years until the Romans came and took it away from them. But that was what Ezekiel was proclaiming to the inhabitants in Babylon, where he was located, that Israel was going to be oppressed for this length of time. Now, another reference which leads us to believe that there will be a considerable gap between the time that Jesus Christ returns until the kingdom age begins is also in Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 20. If you'd like to turn there, you can see another substantial gap that is going to be between the two times, between Christ's return and the kingdom age beginning. Looking at chapter 20, verses 33 to 38. As I live, saith the Lord God, surely with a mighty hand, with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out, will I rule over you. So this is the Jews being taken out of all the nations of the world. And I will bring you out from the people, and I will gather you out of the countries wherein you are scattered with a mighty hand, with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the people, and there will I plead with you face to face, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness in the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you, saith the Lord God. And I will cause you to pass under the rod. And I will bring you into the bond of the covenant, and I will purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgress against me. And I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, and they shall not enter into the land of Israel, and ye shall know that I am the Lord. So with fury poured out, Jesus Christ will rule over them, and he will gather the Jews from all over the world. And it will be a process of time. After Israel left Egypt, it took 40 years in the wilderness for the rebels to be purged out. And likewise, after the return of Jesus Christ to this earth, some of the 8 million Jews that are scattered around the world today will be brought back to the land of Israel. But the rebels will have to be purged out in the wilderness of the 21st century. So it will take 40 years for that job to be done, and Elijah will be involved with that work, as we can read elsewhere. But the key phrase is, as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you, and I will purge out from among you the rebels. Now another event that must happen before the kingdom age can begin is attributed to the prophet Ezekiel again. Looking at Ezekiel chapter 42, Ezekiel 42, verse 20. He measured it by the four sides. He's speaking about the Jerusalem, the temple city of Jerusalem. And he measured it by the four sides. It had a wall round about 500 reeds long, 500 broad, to make a separation between the sanctuary and the profane place. The temple city of Jerusalem, 500 reeds square, a mile by a mile, has to be built. In addition to that city, which has to be built, there must be another city built 20 miles to the south of it. We call it the reception city, located right there, the biggest square. That's obviously, if this is 1 mile square, that little dot there, this dot here is 20 miles square. Both of them are out of scale, but you wouldn't be able to see it if I made it to scale. The verses in Ezekiel chapter 49 verses 15 to 17 describes this second city as 5,000 reeds square. You read carefully verses 15 to 17 of Ezekiel 49, and this second city is 10 times the size of the city. Well, it's 10 miles by 10 miles. I guess that's 100 times bigger, isn't it? 1 mile by 1 mile against 10 miles by 10 miles. The second city is to the south, and it too must be built. And these cities are going to be built by Jews and Gentiles, faithful Jews and Gentiles. Of course, Jesus Christ could, in a flash, create these cities. But we're told in Zechariah 6, verses 12 to 15, that Jesus Christ will build them, and he will have the oversight of people, laborers, building these cities. Isaiah 60, verse 10, tells us that strangers will build up your walls, Jesus Christ being in charge of this rebuilding of the temple city. So it is reasonable that 49 years must go by from the time that Jesus Christ returns until the kingdom age begins. Cities have to be built. Jews have to be gathered from all over the world. Ecclesiastical opposition to the rule of Jesus Christ has to be eliminated. What did we read in Leviticus 25, verse 13? In the year of this jubilee, ye shall return every man to his possession. This is when the Jews will actually get the possession that was promised to Abraham. In the year of this jubilee, ye shall return every man to his possession. And when those 49 years are ended, there will be the sound of the shofar, the jubilee horn. So the millennial age will begin, and you and I can be there. That noise, the shofar, will herald in the jubilee year, the beginning, the first year of the millennium that will happen on this earth. And it is, as you know, the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And we're told in Revelation 5, verse 10, and he has made us unto our God a kingdom and priests, and we shall reign on the earth.